Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, Congresswoman Sarah McBride has officially crossed the 100-day mark serving as Delaware's only congressional representative on Capitol Hill.
Obviously, in the last 100 days in Congress, it's been a lot more of defending Delaware than what I had to do in the state Senate.
Our political reporter Sarah Petrowich sits down with McBride, delving into her policy focuses, the ongoing federal funding cuts, and how she's handling attacks on her identity. I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon. UD researcher Danigal Young also joins the show with a look at how those with a so-called need for chaos are fueling support for Elon Musk and the Trump administration. And we preview the master singers of Wilmington's upcoming New Era Romantics concert of sacred music from the turn of the 20th century. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon, sitting in for Tom Byrne. Monday, April 21st, marked Congresswoman Sarah McBride's 100th day in office, serving as Delaware's lone congressional representative in Washington, D.C. McBride was sworn in on January 23rd, succeeding now U.S. Senator Lisa Blunt Rochester, who represented the first state for nearly a decade. Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrowich sat down this week with the freshman Representative McBride to discuss her policy focuses, fighting back against the Trump administration's federal funding cuts, and how she's handling attacks from the other side of the aisle surrounding her identity.
So first, let's start off with an overview of your transition from state senator to Delaware's lone congressional representative. You're now 100 days into your service. What has the process been like going from representing Delawareans at the local level to representing them at the federal level? How have those two roles differed for you?
Well, when I campaigned for Congress, I said that I would work with anyone who was willing to work with me to help Delawareans and to stand up to anyone who was willing to work with me to defend Delawareans and to stand up against anyone who I believed was hurting Delaware. When I was in the Delaware State Senate, obviously we were moving our state forward. We were passing paid family and medical leave. We were raising the minimum wage. We were passing my Protect Medicaid Act of 2024 to infuse our Medicaid with new resources to improve it and expand it. Obviously, in the last 100 days in Congress, it's been a lot more of defending Delaware than what I had to do in the state Senate. But I continue to employ the same strategies and approaches that I used in the state Senate, which was to bring Delaware elected officials together across political parties to deliver for my constituents. And that's what I've continued to do in Congress. In just 100 days, despite having to defend Delaware from this administration trying to steal millions of dollars from Delaware and Delawareans, despite having to defend Delaware from Republican efforts to gut Medicaid, I've still been able to work across the aisle to deliver for our state. I introduced legislation with bipartisan support to provide consumers with protections and to help support our farmers and lower the cost of groceries for Delaware consumers. When the administration announced that they would be gutting funding for small and medium-sized businesses in manufacturing here in Delaware and across the country, I brought my colleagues together to lead the effort to defend that funding, and the administration listened and reversed course, restoring funding for manufacturing jobs here in Delaware, saving more than 400 jobs and preserving roughly $75 million in economic activity here in Delaware. And so it's been a different environment. It's been a different set of circumstances. We're certainly having to defend a lot more than what I had to do in the state Senate. But fundamentally, the job is similar. The job is the same and the approach is the same, to deliver for Delawareans of every political background and do so by bringing Democrats and Republicans together in Congress to advance compassionate and common sense solutions.
You touched on a lot that I'm hoping we'll break down a little bit further later as well. But one big difference seems to be when you introduce a bill in the Delaware General Assembly, it's likely to get a hearing and lead to a vote within a matter of months, if not weeks, right? But you've introduced some legislation that you just mentioned with your colleagues in Congress that are not moving quite as quickly. So give us some of the highlights of those bills you've introduced and what navigating this new legislative process has been like for you.
Well, Congress just takes a bit more time than the Delaware State Senate. Things moved a little bit quicker in Dover than in D.C. But one of the first steps, particularly in this Congress, given who controls the Congress, is to find bipartisan support for legislation. That's critical in advancing legislation in this Congress in this time. And I'm proud that I was the first freshman Democrat to introduce legislation this Congress. It was the End Scam Credit Repair Act. Legislation that is bipartisan that would protect Delaware consumers from predatory behavior by so-called credit repair organizations, which charge large upfront fees to consumers who want to improve their credit score, all on empty promises. And these organizations often will do almost nothing to actually try to improve a person's credit score after they've charged them a large upfront fee. That bans that kind of predatory, abusive behavior. I joined with a Republican representative in introducing that legislation just a week into serving in the House. It's before a committee. We're having conversations with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to hopefully move forward that legislation this Congress. The second bill that I was really proud to bring Democrats and Republicans together to introduce was the Save Our Poultry Act, which is legislation that would unlock critical funding for research around effective strategies to combat avian flu. This is legislation that was a byproduct of a constituent coming to me, a poultry farmer in Middletown, a guy named Mike Puglisi, who approached me in my office to share his experience in 2022 when one bird in his flock was exposed to avian flu. He had to call his entire stock, which obviously is devastating for a farmer. Fortunately, he was able to survive, but a lot of farmers can't withstand that kind of financial loss. So this legislation would make sure that we are designating avian flu as a disease that the federal government would be unlocking more funding to research effective strategies to combat that preserve our agriculture community, that preserve their stock, that preserve goods at the grocery store for Delaware consumers. Because when a farmer has to call his stock because of avian flu, not only is that a financially devastating toll on his business or her business, it also reduces the stock of chickens available to produce eggs or to be sold at a grocery store, which increases the cost of those goods for all consumers. And so we're working with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to try to advance that legislation too. It takes time, but I'm cautiously optimistic that despite the current party that controls Congress, despite the division and partisan rancor in Congress, that we can continue to make progress on those types of bills and others that we'll be introducing in the weeks and months ahead.
Right, so in addition to the legislation you're working on, it seems as though a lot of the work being done by Democratic legislators is fighting back on the federal funding cuts by the Trump administration, as you mentioned. So you have publicly condemned several of these announcements, but you worked particularly hard to push back on the administration's call for nearly $13 million in funding from the Manufacturing Extension Partnership Program, as you mentioned earlier. It's now reported that the administration is walking that decision back, and funding for the program will now continue through at least the end of the fiscal year. So can you explain what the Manufacturing Extension Partnership is and why you feel it's crucial to fund, particularly for Delawareans?
Well, this is a program that helps to support and empower small and medium-sized manufacturing businesses here in Delaware and across the country. These programs exist in every single state. And a couple of weeks ago, the Trump administration, alongside a series of, you know, dozens over the course of the last 100 days, illegal actions to unilaterally strip funding of critical programs in our communities across the country, the Trump administration announced a couple of weeks ago that they were going to slash funding for the 10 state programs that were up for renewal. Delaware was included in those 10. Now, this was a first step in defunding this program over the next several years nationwide. When I saw that, I knew it needed a response. Manufacturing is a critical part of Delaware's economy. And as the president has, I think, disingenuously said, we're all committed, he's committed, to restoring manufacturing jobs in this country. Now, he's undermining that goal by eliminating programs that help to support small and medium-sized manufacturing businesses. But everyone's in unison in wanting to defend manufacturing. So it was outrageous that this administration would seek to devastate this program that produces jobs in the very industry that we all want to see grow in this country among small and medium-sized businesses. So I brought my colleagues together, more than 80 colleagues to demand the administration restore funding for that program here in Delaware and in the other states that they had slashed funding for. Fortunately, the administration announced that they would be reversing those cuts after we spoke out and reached out. Now, as you mentioned, it's through the end of the year. We're going to have to keep fighting to protect this program, but it's a bridge toward helping to restore and preserve these programs as funding permanently across the country. This is a program that helps to support more than 400 jobs, $75 million in economic activity here in Delaware. I visited a small business in Magnolia, Delaware, that had been the beneficiary, Sue Marie, of this funding in particular. An administration slashing this program would devastate small and medium-sized businesses, entrepreneurs in manufacturing here in Delaware, particularly high-tech manufacturing. I'm glad that they've reversed this cut. And it shows that when we fight back, we can win. We can rein in the worst excesses of this administration if we fight hard and we fight smart. And I'm proud that just in 100 days, we've already, because I brought colleagues together, we are already able to save hundreds of jobs in this state and millions of dollars in economic activity that benefit not only those businesses, but all Delawareans that they serve, that they produce goods for, and that they employ.
And another thing you mentioned was Medicaid. So during your time in the Delaware Senate, you were a fierce advocate for the Medicaid program and continue to be, and funding for public health in general, serving as chair of the State Senate Health and Social Services Committee. In fact, one of your final legislative acts in the state legislature was passing the Protect Medicaid Act of 2024, which will result in more than $100 million in new funding to protect, enhance, and expand Medicaid for Delaware patients. That act is set to go into effect in the new fiscal year, which begins in July 2025 for Delaware. Can you explain if this new federal funding source is threatened in any way and your concerns around the landscape for Medicaid in general under the Trump administration?
Well, I was proud during my time in the Delaware General Assembly to tackle some really big issues, including as chair of the Health Committee, bringing together Democrats and Republicans to pass the Protect Medicaid Act of 2024, which is set to result in the largest ongoing infusion of new resources into our state's Medicaid program, which one in four Delawareans rely on for health coverage, the largest ongoing infusion into that program of new resources since the Affordable Care Act passed a bit over a decade ago. Unfortunately, while I hoped to be entering Congress at a time when we'd be building on the progress of the Affordable Care Act, when we'd be building on the progress that I helped deliver here in Delaware with the Protect Medicaid Act of 2024, unfortunately, I'm entering Congress at a time when we are having to defend that program from a heartless Republican budget that would result in the largest cut in Medicaid in American history, a cut that would devastate care for one in four Delawareans, including nearly one in two kids in this state, devastate care for people trying to get treatment for cancer, devastate care for new moms, devastate care for seniors in Delaware or people with disabilities who rely on assisted living support or facilities. I'm doing all I can alongside Senator Coons and Senator Blunt Rochester to sound the alarm about these cuts, to fight back against these cuts. I've already voted against these cuts twice in Congress as this legislation begins to make its way through the legislative process. And I'll continue to fight to not only defend Medicaid, but to improve it. We should be protecting and improving Medicaid alongside Medicare and Social Security, but instead we're in a position where we have to defend it from an administration that is trying to gut Medicaid, an administration that's trying to privatize Medicare, an administration that's trying to demonize Social Security, calling it a Ponzi scheme in an effort to ultimately privatize it. These are lifelines for Delawareans, and I will stop at nothing, as I promised during the course of the campaign, to defend Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security.
Absolutely. And so if these cuts were to go into effect, you know, based on the Protect Medicaid Act, is there any other source of funding you think that can be tapped or any other way that you're looking at to help bring more resources into Delaware specifically for this program?
Well, there are a lot of unknowns around the specifics of the cuts. What we know is that Republicans have now voted twice to require cuts to Medicaid. What those specific cuts are remains to be seen. It is possible that this heartless Republican budget could undermine the progress we made here in Delaware with the Protect Medicaid Act of 2024. It's something I'm keeping a close eye on. There is a world in which the Protect Medicaid Act of 2024, unfortunately, it might not be able to be used to expand and enhance Medicaid as it was originally intended. It might have to be used to fill holes that this administration is creating by slashing Medicaid funding at the federal level. So it remains to be seen exactly what those cuts will look like, exactly what the parameters of those cuts would be. We know they would have real consequences no matter what shape or form they are in for patients and providers alike across Delaware. It'll make healthcare more expensive. It'll make healthcare harder to get. It'll undermine coverage for some of the most vulnerable in our state. But the specifics will allow us, once we know them, to understand exactly how that Protect Medicaid Act will play in and how it will be impacted and how it can be used to help to offset some of the devastating consequences for Delawareans. And I will continue to fight back so that we don't see any cut to Medicaid, because we still have time. This is still in the legislative process. And if enough people speak out and fight back, as I continue to lift the voices of Delawareans who have reached out to me to share how Medicaid has either enhanced their life or saved their life, I've not given up yet on saving Medicaid at the federal level from this Republican budget that would devastate it.
Pivoting a little bit, before you were even sworn in, and particularly during your first few weeks in Congress, you faced various pointed attacks from your Republican colleagues around your identity, ranging from public misgendering to even bathroom bans, but I do want to note you've also had a lot of support. You are notably the first openly transgender member of Congress in U.S. history, but you have always centered your platform around your policy goals, not your identity. Can you reflect a little bit, though, on how this hostility from some of your Republican colleagues, not all, and even the public, and how that has impacted your time in office, if at all, and how it's evolved during your first 100 days?
So I think what was so key in the way you asked that question is that you reinforced the truth, which is that it's some of my Republican colleagues. This is a handful of members of the Republican caucus who won't work with any Democrat, can barely work with their own Republican colleagues, who have decided to try to get clicks and attention. That is what this is about. This is about a handful of Republican politicians who are employing the strategies of reality TV to get more attention on social media. I don't have any time for that. I am not going to let these attention-seeking provocateurs do anything to distract me from what I am there to do, which is to focus on serious issues, to be a serious legislator, to bring people together to tackle the real problems that this country has. Throwing fights about another member's pronoun or another member's bathroom use is silly season. And unfortunately, those Republicans are getting attention with their silly antics and their behavior, their schoolyard taunts. But I don't think that what they are doing speaks to the needs of their constituents. They'll have to answer to their constituents about what they're spending their time prioritizing. But I continue to prioritize lowering costs facing Delawareans. I continue to prioritize respecting all Delawareans, regardless of their background, regardless of their political persuasion. I continue to prioritize working with Democrats and Republicans alike to do serious work. Because this is a serious responsibility. To be a member of Congress, especially at this moment in our country's history, is a serious responsibility. This is a serious time. It demands serious people. And it's unfortunate that there are a handful of members of the Republican caucus who are committed to being unserious.
So Congress is set to return on Monday. What can we expect your focus to be during your next 100 days in office?
Well, at the top of the list continues to be defending Medicaid from this Republican budget. It continues to be making sure that Delawareans are able to get the care and support that they need, especially as they are navigating a serious illness or a disability. That is what drove me into politics. It's why I passed paid leave at the state level. It's why I passed the Protect Medicaid Act. And I will stop at nothing to defend healthcare for my constituents. I will also continue to look for opportunities where we can find bipartisan support for compassionate and common sense solutions like what I've already done in the first 100 days. And I look forward to introducing more bills in the days, weeks, and months ahead, bringing Democrats and Republicans together to tackle serious issues facing my constituents, especially as it relates to our economy. In addition to that, throughout all of my time in Congress, I will continue to be particularly focused on the individual needs of Delawareans who reach out to my office for help. Over the last 100 days, our constituent advocates here, our all-star team of constituent advocates, have returned or delivered $360,000 worth of money owed to individual Delawareans in the forms of veterans benefits that people who have served our country are entitled to, in the form of Social Security benefits that Delawareans, that seniors were entitled to and deserved, in the form of tax refunds that people were owed. People are reaching out to our office as a front door to the federal government in moments of stress and need. And we will continue to prioritize delivering for those constituents. I'm proud that in 100 days, more than 300 Delawareans have reached out to our office. We can't solve every problem, but more than 300 Delawareans have reached out to us for help, and we have 100% satisfaction rate from those Delawareans who have reached out. Again, we've delivered $360,000 to Delawareans that they are entitled to from the federal government. We'll continue to deliver for Delawareans what they are deserving of and entitled to. And throughout all of that time, I've also traveled across the state. Because part of this job, it's not just being on the House floor making speeches, it's not just introducing legislation, it's also meeting with Delawareans. And we've added 3,000 miles to the odometer traveling across the state over the last 100 days, meeting with farmers and first responders, meeting with doctors and nurses, educators, meeting with hospitals and federally qualified health centers, meeting with small businesses, meeting with individual Delawareans, hearing their stories, hearing what is keeping them up at night, hearing their hopes and their fears in this moment. And my job is to continue to travel across the state, continue to meet with Delawareans so that I can continue to be a voice for them and continue to bring their stories and their voices to the halls of Congress so that we continue to prioritize issues that actually matter to voters. That will be my priority in the remaining year and 9 months of my term. And it's also what buoys me. Because politics is a rough and tumble business at the federal level. There's too much toxicity and partisan division and rancor at the federal level. But what gives me the energy, what gives me the hope, what gives me the determination to continue to do that work are the conversations that I have with Delawareans, the support that I've received from Delawareans despite what some members of Congress decide to do, and the awe-inspiring responsibility that they have entrusted me with over the next several years to represent them in the United States House of Representatives. And it's important to not only be grateful, but to continue to ground my work in what I hear from them.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrowich and to Congresswoman Sarah McBride for joining us this week on The Green. And stay with us. New data from the Center for Political Communication at the University of Delaware finds that a number of people in the U.S. have what researchers call a, quote, need for chaos. We explore what that need for chaos is and what it says about our democracy next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon. Some people just want to watch the world burn. It's an iconic line from the 2008 Batman film The Dark Knight, but for some Americans, it's more than just a line. It's a reflection of how they actually feel about the country's political system. That's according to new data from the Center for Political Communication at the University of Delaware, which finds that a number of people in the U.S. have what researchers call a need for chaos, a desire to tear down social and political order, and it's those with these views that are placing more trust in figures like Elon Musk, President Trump, and the Department of Government Efficiency, also known as DOGE. This week, I spoke with UD Professor of Communication and Political Science, Dana Gal Young, about how this need for chaos is fueling support for Musk and Trump, and what it reveals about the state of U.S. democracy. Dana Gal, a good place for us to start this need for chaos chat is with that phrase itself. I just outlined that it's essentially a desire to tear down social and political order, but in your words, can you tell us what exactly it means to be someone with a need for chaos? You know, who are these people?
So my co-author, Kevin Arsenault, had written a piece a few years back with some colleagues where the piece was entitled, "Some People Just Want to Watch the World Burn, the Prevalence, Psychology, and Politics of the Need for Chaos." And it was in this article where they really introduced this, what's a psychological construct that captures a certain kind of person. And first, let me just say, this isn't something that's super prevalent in the population. It's a small number, very small number. But the way that they define it, that this need for chaos is something where, you hear that line from Batman that Alfred says to Batman about the Joker, explaining why the Joker just seems so hell-bent on chaos and destruction, but he doesn't want money or power. He just wants chaos and destruction. And Alfred says, some people just want to watch the world burn. And that really is what the need for chaos is. It's people who agree with sentiments like, and we have certain items we ask people, like, to what extent do you agree with the following? I think society should be burned to the ground. We cannot fix the problems in our social institutions. We need to tear them down and start over. Or, I need chaos around me. It's too boring if nothing's going on. And another one, I fantasize about a natural disaster wiping out most of humanity such that a small group of people can start all over. And to be clear, again, historically, most of these items receive fewer than 10 to 15% of the population strongly or somewhat agreeing with them. In our study, we did find for that one item, we cannot fix the problems in our social institutions. We need to tear them down and start over. We had about 18% of the population overall agreeing with that one. Now, these are folks historically who perceive that they are losing power and status. The people who agree with these, with the idea that, I want the whole system to burn, maybe so we can start over, maybe just so it can be destroyed. These are folks who, for whatever reason, because of this combination of their underlying psychological predispositions and whatever is going on in the world around them, their response to this perception of status loss and status threat is that they just want to burn it down. Historically, I'd say over the last few years since this was introduced, these are items that are more agreed to by men, by younger people, and by those who have fewer years of education. So that's kind of who we're talking about here.
Beyond who these people are, this small faction, and how we measure this need for chaos in them, how is, again, this need for chaos tangibly showing up today in terms of happenings or how it, physically looks and feels? How is it showing up in our country's political life? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think one of the most concerning pieces of this is that while there aren't a whole lot of people who score high in this trait, those who do are significantly more open to the use of political violence to achieve their goals. They also are more likely to report a willingness to share hostile, hateful, or false information online. And they admit that that's just something that they see perhaps as fun, as entertaining. Maybe it's part of an effort to sort of, destroy the social order. That's, I think, where most people would run into this is when you see folks online who are really hostile, who perhaps are engaging in trolling behaviors, really hateful content, and you think, who the heck are these people? Well, one of the traits that they may embody is a need for chaos. And even though there are very few people who have this trait, one person can make a whole lot of hateful and harmful content online.
Right, and that's where this can be particularly concerning because it's not all visible destruction and Molotov cocktails and Teslas and whatnot. This need for chaos shows up in or it can at least in fairly subtle ways. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. And I would say, the sort of mis and disinformation ecosystem right now is so in need of study. And that's an area that this administration has been cutting, the any NSF research grants that were aimed at the study of mis and disinformation have been canceled by the administration because they do not align with their goals. And they suggest that it could infringe upon free speech rights of others. And while I'm sympathetic to that sort of larger mission, there are pieces of information that are demonstrably false and that we know to be false and that we know to be not just empirically wrong, but false in a way that can cause harmful outcomes, societally, socially, politically, economically, or in terms of health.
Well, from a labeling standpoint, and I can imagine the positives around essentially calling this, again, this small faction of people, calling them by their name, so to speak. But, what are those benefits, those positives of labeling this section, this faction, as those with a need for chaos?
Can be useful for folks who are operating in good faith, especially in online social networks, to understand that their sort of good faith operation and their sort of shared vision of engaging with people in a productive way is not held, it's not necessarily shared or held by all. And it can be useful to just understand when you're encountering an individual who may be trolling you that it just does not. There's no goal in mind, right? They're not trying to understand you. They're not trying to engage with you. It really is completely worth it to just simply disengage. So in that regard, I think it's useful. I think it's also useful from the standpoint of recognizing that this perception of status threat is so at play in our politics right now that there are people who feel like they're losing out and that they're losing either their rightful place or even their ability to get ahead. And while, need for chaos is just one very dysfunctional manifestation of that feeling, to the extent that we can engage with people in a way that minimizes their sense of their status being threatened or that they're losing out. And to the extent that we can provide pathways for people to see that they do have a voice and they do have a say, and there are ways for them to affect change productively through the institutions we have, I think that would benefit us all rather than sort of sending people down this path of, destruction of everything is my only option.
And there is some interesting nuance here, this really quite fascinating push and pull almost. And you've certainly touched on this, but what is this need for chaos rooted in as far as why figures like President Trump and Elon Musk are directly resonating with people who feel this way?
So our data just show that there is a correlation between people who score higher in need for chaos and people being more trusting, placing more trust in Elon Musk, President Trump, and the organization that Trump created to cut federal bureaucracy that is called the Department of Government Efficiency that Musk heads up. Now, we don't know the underlying mechanism that accounts for why there's this positive correlation, but there are some intuitive connections you can make. These results hold even when we control for all kind of socio-demographic and political characteristics. Even if we have all of those in the model, it's still the case that the people who want to see the world burn are the ones who show more trust in Elon Musk and President Trump. And I think that that could simply be an outgrowth of this sort of symbolic vision of Doge being a bit of a renegade organization, firing people that kind of the tech culture of move fast and break things, firing, thousands of government workers, Elon Musk showing up at the Conservative Political Action Conference with a chainsaw on stage, joking about cutting the government, like not carefully with a scalpel, but, aggressively with a chainsaw. And for folks who feel that the system is not benefiting them and is not working and who feel that they're losing out, that kind of aggressive anti-institutional take could be very attractive.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen or heard the term speak softly and carry a big stick, famously said many times by Roosevelt, used more in this time period. And that being said, used more out of context in this time period. So from where you sit, Danegal, what can this then tell us about where, again, this is things that we've touched on a bit, but you know, again, from where you sit, what can this all tell us about where public trust is in our current system, our democracy, where that all stands right now? What leaders should be paying attention to, or is this faction really, you know, as meaningful as it is, is it too small for that to really resonate in a question like that?
Yeah, I think because that it's a small minority, I wouldn't want to exaggerate how much we should be concerned about it. My real goal in, you know, putting this together was revealing the fact that there are certain individuals who have an itch that's being scratched by this administration. And there are people who really do like the idea of kind of burning it down and maybe starting over, maybe. I would say from my vantage point, the important piece here is as we experience these cuts, as these government agencies are going to, especially over the coming 6 months, there may be delays, there may be studies that aren't completed and clinical trials, there may be folks at Social Security who go to the office that's now going to be farther away from their home than it used to be, and maybe they wait longer on the phone, or, you know, maybe you can't go to the national park you thought you were going to go to this summer because the national park has been closed. When things become tangible to people, I do think that that need for chaos changes shape. Because if you are an individual who receives Social Security benefits or who does, you know, like to go to national campgrounds or national parks, and the tangible outcomes of these actions have been that you aren't going to be able to do the things you wanted to do. You may before have felt like, wow, the system doesn't really work for me. But it's possible that as a result of some of these cuts, you'll be like, wow, I didn't think the system worked great then, but it doesn't work at all now. And I wonder if that might change the sort of view of some of these folks.
I can imagine that it just might, even early on in this administration and some of the actions they've taken. But in closing, you know, what do you think, you know, these traditional institutions, including entities like the media, might be missing about these people with a need for chaos? Again, it's a small faction and whatnot. But what's the disconnect, if any at all?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. My sense is that these are folks who are probably not consuming at least not traditional news from mainstream outlets. There is a real sense among some people that they are falling behind. And, you know, people can say, oh, well, they shouldn't be feeling that way, or perhaps that's a false perception. You can call it whatever you want. It's the reality for these individuals. And, you know, media organizations could benefit from looking with some empathy at folks who feel as though the system has not been meeting their needs, and being open to the possibility that there are ways that their own jobs, their own roles, perhaps haven't been fulfilled to meet their needs. Perhaps giving voice to certain viewpoints, or allowing for the possibility that there's alternate voices to come into the conversation.
Thanks to UD Professor of Communication and Political Science Danegal Young for taking some time to join me this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Art's Playlist and a preview of the Master Singers of Wilmington's upcoming New Era Romantics concert of sacred music from around the turn of the 20th century. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm your host, Kyle McKinnon. The Master Singers of Wilmington have been a staple of Delaware's music scene for years. Made up of both professional and amateur singers, the ensemble has become known for its rich sound and moving performances. and their upcoming concert, New Era Romantics, promises more of the same, offering music from around the turn of the 20th century and one of the major choral pieces from that period, The Requiem by Maurice Duruflay. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by local musician Jordan Barrett, board president of Market Street Music, which the Master Singers are a part of, and conductor David Shalott, for an early look at New Era Romantics.
Let me start with you, Jordan, by asking you to tell me a little bit about the Master Singers of Wilmington.
So Master Singers of Wilmington is really Wilmington's premier choral ensemble. It's uniquely wonderful in that you have all the quality and richness and beauty of a true professional ensemble, yet it's actually semi-professional. So it's about half professional singers and half high-level volunteers. And one of the great things about that is that the amateur singers get this opportunity to participate in a very high level of music making that is really rare outside the professional world. And yet the quality is so high that we have professional singers from as far away as New York City and Baltimore who come to us because they really love singing with us. And so it really fulfills our mission of providing really high quality performances for the community and also high quality performing opportunities for artists.
Turning to you now, David, you're the conductor of this ensemble. Tell me about the program and the music the Master Singers are performing.
Well, the program is a really interesting one that takes a look at music, choral music, from the end of the 19th century into about the first half of the 20th century, and how it evolved and changed, but was always looking back to the 19th century as it changed and evolved. It's a really fascinating program. Starts with a wonderful mass by Louis Vierne, who was a French composer at Notre Dame Cathedral. And so this piece was written for there and very, very much in the 19th century mold. And then we end with one of the greatest choral pieces of the 20th century, the Requiem of Maurice Duruflay, also a French composer, and a terrific piece based on Gregorian chant. But in between, we have a piece by Howells and also this most fascinating piece by Gustav Holst, who is a British composer, written right at the beginning of the 20th century, that examines music that you might not associate with England. They're called choral hymns from the Rig Veda, and they are based in the Hindu religion. There are four movements of this for sopranos and altos and harp. And they're all prayers to various Hindu gods. It's quite fascinating and very, very exotic sounding.
As I was studying up for our conversation today, I stumbled on a really interesting fact. Gustav Holst actually taught himself Sanskrit in preparation for writing the choral hymns from the Rig Veda. Is that right?
Exactly right. He was not satisfied with the translations of the Rig Veda that were available. And so Holst himself learned Sanskrit, which is, of course, a language that people don't speak any longer, and made his own translation for these.
It strikes me that when we think about choral music, we think a lot of times about sacred music, and there are all sacred texts on this concert, but not all of them are from the Christian faith. For example, the Holst.
That's correct. The church has supported choral music for centuries and centuries. And so that's why there's so much choral music that is written with Christian texts. But there is also lots and lots of music that is performed less often that does not have Christian texts. These texts from this tradition that doesn't really have a choral tradition are just fascinating to hear in this choral setting with just incredibly exotic sounds, new harmonies for the 20th century, lots of fun dissonances that probably would not have happened in the 19th century. And of course, with the addition of harp, which is just an amazingly ethereal sound and just adds this touch of just incredible beauty to these wonderfully exotic pieces.
Jordan, let me turn to you. I'd like to hear your viewpoint on this as a singer. Singers, especially professional singers, are well accustomed to singing in Romance languages, singing in German, singing in Latin. The Holst, of course, written for just women's voices, and a lot of it is in English. But from your experience as a singer, can you reflect a little bit on what it's like having to learn to sing in a very, very different language family?
I'm not singing this piece, but you know, when I've had opportunities to sing pieces in, say, Czech or something like that, it is a totally foreign experience because when you train as a singer, you do get some Italian and some German and some French, and those feel kind of familiar. And so you have to kind of figure out how to make these sounds that are totally unfamiliar made out of sounds that you know how to do. Now for the Holst piece, of course, it's mostly in English, except for kind of the names of the gods themselves. And so it's not too far of a reach, I think.
That what's interesting, what has been interesting about the rehearsal process for these wonderful choral hymns from the Rig Veda is that one of our amateur singers is from India. And so she has been able to tell us a little bit about each of these gods talked about in these four movements.
One thing that strikes me about this concert is the through line from Louis Vierne to Maurice Duruflé, because they were friends and colleagues, right?
Duruflé was Vierne's assistant at Notre Dame. And as a matter of fact, there's a kind of an amazing story in the organ world of Vierne playing his who knows how many concerts he did at Notre Dame, many, 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 many. But at his last one, Duruflé was helping, assisting at the console. And at the end of this concert, Vierne died and Duruflé was there. So right there, he played a low E in the pedals, and that was all he wrote.
Just how he would have wanted it, I'm sure.
Let me ask you, Jordan, are there specific moments in this music that really kind of stand out to you, kind of give you goosebumps?
Well, some of the standouts for me are moments when I'm not singing because I just get to kind of sit there and listen. And a striking moment for me is the Howells piece that David talked about before, which is a setting of the Magnificat text, which is, of course, Mary's kind of proclamation and understanding that she is about to be the mother of Christ. And there are just scads of compositions and settings of this text done by, old dead white guys. Most of the time, originally, this would have been done by a choir of boys and men. And the opening of this piece has the beginning of the Magnificat text in all treble voices, sopranos and altos. And in this group in particular, you get to hear it done by adult women rather than boys, which that sound of treble boys in a choir is a uniquely wonderful one, but I think it's actually really touching and wonderful to have this text spoken by a woman that is set so often by old dead white guys, actually sung by mature women. It's a wonderful, touching, beautiful, and it's one of the most musically beautiful moments in the whole concert, I think.
And to you, David, what do you hope listeners will take away from this performance?
I hope that people who attend this concert will go away actually being changed by experiencing this music. And intellectually, they can maybe see the growth of music or change of music from the 19th century to the mid 20th century. And that's all very interesting and intellectually stimulating. But more than that, I think that hearing live music and sung by such a remarkably beautiful ensemble of voices, I think that people will go away with kind of a new lease on life. There's lots and lots of troubles in the world right now, and this will give you just a respite from that and change you as a human being.
Finally, let me ask you about the environment, the performance space. If you'll talk a little bit about the room in which people are going to hear this music.
Well, I mean, it's one of the best rooms for choral singing that that I have sung in. It's a, about 100-year-old church, and it is mostly white inside, so it's bright and just a nice sort of warm but happy feeling. But then the sound, I believe it's called a barrel vault ceiling, so there's kind of a curve at the top, and that's known to create a wonderful acoustical space. So, you don't exactly have the 8-second reverb of Notre Dame Cathedral like the original setting for the Vierne Mass, but you have a wonderfully reverberant sound, and it's very generous to voices. And so it really just kind of polishes the sound just enough without making it sound like a bathtub. It's just one of the best rooms that I've sung in.
Yeah, I would agree with Jordan. And I know that we've had other ensembles for Market Street Music come and sing at First and Central Church. And they come in saying, "This is my favorite room to sing in. I just love singing in this space. It just feels good to sing in there. It's a room that is meant for singing, I think."
David Chalot and Jordan Barrett, thank you both so much and best of luck with the concert.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate this.
Thanks to local musician and Market Street Music Board President Jordan Barrett, conductor David Chalot, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. The Master Singers of Wilmington's New Era Romantics Concert is set for Saturday, May 10th at 3 p.m. at Wilmington's First and Central Presbyterian Church. Visit the Greens page at DelawarePublic.org for more information. And that's it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also love to hear from you, the listener. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. My thanks to our political reporter, Sarah Petrowich, and our Morning Edition host/reporter, Martin Matheny, for helping make this week's show possible. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Kyle McKinnon, saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned in to a first state of mind.